From Michigan Radio, directly to you, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, U.S. Senator Gary Peters on the war of words between President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un.
I think we've all seen this kind of banter back and forth. We've experienced it when we were in grade school and in middle school, but it certainly doesn't have a place on the world stage.
We'll hear from our investigative reporter, Lindsay Smith, who's been looking at a new study that finds Flint's lead-contaminated water affected fertility and caused fetal deaths.
Lead that collects into a mom's bloodstream, it does cross the placenta line.
Some news on State of Michigan commissions has us asking why we have these unelected bodies.
It's always an ongoing debate about whether their authority is too little or too much.
Plus, a Grand Rapids distiller and its Beer City whiskey. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Yesterday, my colleague Lindsay Smith, the investigative reporter at Michigan Radio, reported on a study that suggests a connection between the lead-contaminated water in Flint and lower fertility rates and a higher fetal death rate in the city. Lindsay joins me now. What are the data in this research?
The data show that there was a 12% decrease in the fertility rate in Flint, and there was a 58% increase in the fetal death rate. Not a 58% increase in fetal deaths, which I think is, that would be a huge increase. We're talking about the fetal death rate, which in and of itself is pretty small. You're talking about 30 fetal deaths in Genesee County as a whole in 2015. But it was a statistically significant, noticeable difference in that amount. And they kind of tallied this up and tried to see, what did that mean? Ultimately, they decided their mathematical models showed between about 200 and 300 kids that would have been born had they not switched the water source.
So help me understand, what is it about lead that causes lower fertility rates in these fetal deaths?
So lead is, it's really bad for the body. We know that.
It's toxic. We know that.
Of course, yeah. And it affects all organ systems. It's especially hard on nervous systems. So when you think about, a developing fetus, lead that collects into a mom's bloodstream, it does cross the placenta line. So that is going to go from the mother's body into the fetus.
Who did this research?
This was done by a couple of economic professors, which I thought was kind of interesting. A guy out of University of Kansas and another out of University of West Virginia. And they've done these kinds of health mathematical models and they have other published papers and that kind of thing.
So this is not their first go around.
No.
We should note that this study has not been peer reviewed, which is generally what happens when you publish something. Other scientists check your work, sort of.
Yes.
So how do we know it's sound research?
Well, that was one of the first things that, us in the newsroom kind of raised our eyebrows about. We're always hesitant to bring to the fore, these kinds of not peer-reviewed studies. So we definitely did a lot of background checks before we wrote about it. And I think what sort of did it for me was, one is, there's nothing in this research that's super shocking or unexpected, I'll put it that way. They put numbers to something that is generally understood happens. We saw the same thing happen in Washington, D.C. Virginia Tech professor Mark Edwards studied that in depth, and his numbers...
And you were talking about the lead contamination.
The lead contamination in D.C. His numbers, Mark Edwards' numbers for the D.C. crisis... These numbers line up with that. They're very similar numbers. And we did go to Mark Edwards and say, hey, what do you think about this? And he at first had some skepticism. And by the end of the afternoon, when he had a chance to read through the whole thing, told us, look, this data is out there. You can repeat this study. And their methods, from what I can tell, look sound. And we didn't get any pushback, really.
So you did your own peer review.
in the best way that a reporter can. Yeah. We also reached out to some of the doctors at the Hurley Medical Center. That's something that they're looking at, too, in the state. Nobody gave us any, big warning red flags. It was like, this is not okay.
Yeah, so. That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, these researchers out of Kansas and West Virginia look into fertility rates and fetal death rates, but why hasn't someone in Michigan done that kind of research already?
So a couple things. There are groups in Michigan that are studying this. There are also other groups outside of Michigan that are studying this. So I would expect that we're going to see more studies like this come out that are trying to quantify some of these things. The group at Hurley Medical Center in Flint that has been doing these studies, I mean, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha is a very well-known figure in this crisis. She told me since they are doing this work, but they are also, their main goal really is to help people currently dealing with the water crisis. Like, this already happened, right? The water is technically safe to drink now, right? It meets all the rules. So they are trying to really keep their focus on what they can do to help people right now. The state is also studying this data, and they are working with the CDC, they tell me, and a couple of other outside experts. So they tell me, the Department of Health and Human Services, this is, that they will have a similar study coming out in the next few months.
So they're working on it,
yes.
And Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha is looking at it. So at least there's going to be some verification here, one way or the other, or maybe contradictions. We don't know yet.
And this study will go out to be peer-reviewed.
Right.
So we will get that feedback at some point on this study.
Lindsay Smith is investigative reporter for Michigan Radio and headed up our Flint investigation team. Thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
This week, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, arrested 10 workers at a farm labor camp near Hart, Michigan. The undocumented immigrants were harvesting crops at a farm, and joining us to talk about that is Susan Reed. She's the managing attorney with the Michigan Immigrants' Rights Center. I understand these 9 men and one woman, worked all day harvesting, and then ICE agents raided the camp. Where are they now?
Well, I will say we believe that they had finished harvesting blueberries earlier in the season, so we don't think that they worked harvesting blueberries on Tuesday, but indeed they did work the whole blueberry season. The 9 men have been taken to a detention facility in Youngstown, Ohio, which is about 480 miles from where they were picked up. The one woman, we believe, was taken to the Calhoun County Jail.
How often do Michigan farmers rely on undocumented migrant farm workers?
You know, it's estimated that about half of Michigan's agricultural workforce is undocumented. The other half, approximately, I mean, it's difficult to estimate, but the best estimates I've seen being a combination of green card holders or immigrants with other statuses and U.S. citizens. And you have a great deal of mixed immigration status families. So you may have work-authorized individuals in the families who work, but other family members who live in the farm labor housing and maybe take care of children who migrate with the family. And Michigan has around 100,000 farm workers and household members who are involved in migrant and seasonal farm work. So it's a significant number of people.
If these workers, some of them, are undocumented, why do farmers hire them? Why don't they check their papers or for that matter, hire local people to do the work?
You know, we see a variety of practices. There certainly are employers who have workers work for cash, and there may be an understanding that workers are not authorized. Some workers, you know, do have false documents. That's not uncommon. Local workers are certainly always welcome to apply and may even have a preference for some of the jobs, especially if the grower has put in an order for foreign guest workers. But, you know, there are generations-long relationships of families in some of these cases, and maybe a cousin or a family member has come along without status, or in some cases, we see employers often use farm labor contractors, and those farm labor contractors can be very exploitative. The farmer may not know or fully be aware of the degree to which people may be in a trafficking or quasi-trafficking situation. So there's just a huge variety of practices, but the reality is that many people who work very hard to harvest our crops don't have immigration status.
The Trump administration has said there was going to be a pause in ICE raids during the hurricanes in Texas and Florida. I take it that pause is over?
Well, you know, I'm honestly not sure. There was the unusual situation a few weeks ago where It became public information that a large ICE raid that planned to target and result in the arrests of almost 9,000 people nationwide, it was supposed to be called Operation Mega, was planned. And then, as you noted, there was some indication that it had been canceled because of the hurricanes. It was never clear to me that the operation was canceled nationwide, and there's some indication that places like Michigan still had their quotas to meet. I can tell you that our phones have absolutely blown up this week. We had callers reporting a raid in a Meijer parking lot in Flint, many callers reporting home pickups of folks by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, other scenarios, roadside stops. But, you know, this pickup of 10 farm workers at a farm worker housing site was especially significant to us given our focus on farm workers.
So these aren't isolated events, it sounds like. So what happens from here? I mean, are the laborers at the various farms across western Michigan, all of Michigan, now on high alert for ICE agents?
I mean, to some degree, that's always the case in any community where you have a variety of immigration statuses. You know, anecdotally, Grand Rapids Channel 13 reporter in his story found a number of farm labor housing sites that were sort of expected to be filled with workers ready to work in the apple season. So, you know, we are hearing from farm worker advocates that, you know, are involved in the migrant Head Start programs or involved in providing services to farm workers about just a lot of fear and anxiety that this event has created.
Susan Reed is managing attorney with the Michigan Immigrants Rights Center. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you, Lester.
Coming up, expect a rise in immigration from the Caribbean.
Prior migrants who are already U.S. citizens and permanent residents are applying for green cards for their relatives who want to come over because they're suffering from the bad effects of a hurricane.
Plus, our Cheers segment, turning craft beer into whiskey. That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. While the politicians argue about it, the U.S. Department of Defense is trying to prepare for the effects of climate change. The Pentagon sees it as a security issue. One of the predictions is that there will be massive migration because of extreme weather events leading to flooding or drought or other disasters. There's some evidence of that kind of thing happening because of hurricanes. An article in The Conversation is titled, "Hurricanes Drive Immigration to the U.S." Dean Yang is one of the co-authors, and he joins us now via Skype. You find recovery from the kinds of hurricanes we've seen this year is slower in poorer and smaller countries outside the U.S. So how does that affect immigration to this country?
What we find in this work is that immigration rises quite remarkably after countries are hit by hurricanes overseas. But that effect really is isolated in countries that have large migrant populations in the U.S. already who can help ease the way for new migrants to come in response to hurricanes.
Right. So tell me how that happens. I mean, in what ways do they ease the way for fellow countrymen?
There are a number of ways in which migrants might ease the way for fellow countrymen, but the one that we can say for sure is going on because we can see it in the data is that prior migrants who are already U.S. citizens and permanent residents are applying for green cards for their relatives who want to come over because they're suffering from the bad effects of a hurricane. We can definitely see that in the U.S. immigration data when a country is hit by a hurricane. In the following year, we see a big increase in green card issuances by the U.S. government to people from that country. It's quite remarkably driven by applications on the part of very close relatives, you know, parents, children, spouses of people who are already in the U.S. on with citizenship or green cards already themselves.
What countries or regions are more likely to see hurricane-caused migration?
Certainly the region that this is happening most prominently is Central America and the Caribbean. Central America and the Caribbean, you know, is obviously very close to the U.S., and so there are large migrant populations already in the U.S. from many countries in the region. There's a number of examples of fairly large hurricane-induced migration over the last couple of decades from this region. For example, Hurricane Mitch that hit Honduras in 1998 led to, you know, widely discussed and documented inflows into the U.S. from Honduras in 2001 and thereafter. This is actually not a hurricane, but sort of a similar event. You know, major earthquakes in El Salvador drove a lot of migrants from El Salvador into the U.S. in the wake of that disaster.
You also found that some countries are less likely to see post-storm migration to the U.S. Your example is Bangladesh, which saw a terrible tropical cyclone in 1988, resulting in thousands of people dying and about half the country's crops were destroyed, yet not many migrants to the U.S. in that case. Why?
That's right. I mean, Bangladesh, you're absolutely right, experienced a huge amount of human tragic losses as well as economic losses in response to that hurricane in 1998. But following that, there was no recognizable uptick in migration to the U.S. from Bangladesh. We think that there's a straightforward explanation for that. It's just that, you know, there is not a large pre-existing population of Bangladeshi migrants in the U.S. who could ease the way for new migrants to come over via sort of formal sponsorship for green cards or other ways in which migrant populations might help new migrants come over.
So what does your research reveal about U.S. immigration policy, especially the new restrictions we've seen recently?
Probably the most important thing that our research says about policy is that the family reunification-based policies that we have in the United States today are very effective at helping people overseas cope with the negative consequences of natural disasters by emigrating to the U.S., if they have relatives already in the U.S. themselves. And so we need to keep in mind this real benefit that people get from international migration if we are thinking about any changes to immigration policy. Now, at the moment, I don't imagine there are, you know, changes underway to the, you know, family reunification-based policies that we have right now in the U.S. These are very popular, and I haven't heard anything about plans to change those, but in this new political environment we're in, anything can happen. And so it's important to understand that these policies really are important in helping people overseas who might have relatives already in the U.S. cope with disaster by being able to emigrate to the U.S.
Dean Yang is a professor in the Department of Economics and the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. He is co-author of the article, Hurricanes Drive Immigration to the U.S. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thanks for talking with us.
I'm happy to be here.
This week, the Michigan Civil Service Commission unilaterally restricted state labor union workers' rights. Emily Lawler for MLive reports the rule changes prohibit some issues as subjects of collective bargaining and take away specific provisions unions have negotiated for around seniority bumping, overtime scheduling, and transfers, as well as restrict the paid union leave time state employees use to work on union issues. Here's Civil Service Commission and former House Speaker Jace Bolger on that decision.
We heard the examples of the silliness of seniority, where somebody's time serving with the state in a different capacity wouldn't be counted just because they didn't belong to that union. So I think this improves the process and ultimately is more responsible for taxpayers.
Hundreds of union members disagreed, and some past state officials argued against it, saying it wasn't right to change things that were negotiated in good faith. But the commission made a decision, changed the rules, and that was that. Also this week, another commission, the Civil Rights Commission, held a public hearing after weeks of work on whether protections against sex discrimination apply to LGBT people. My colleague Rick Pluta reported the Civil Rights Commission was going to proceed toward a ruling, but a lawyer from Attorney General Bill Schuette stopped the proceedings, saying it's a matter for the legislature to decide. And that was that. Joining me now are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. Vicki, why does one commission seem to have power to change things, but the other doesn't?
It depends on how they were established in the state constitution, and both of these are constitutional bodies. The Civil Rights Commission is constitutionally charged with investigating crimes of discrimination or accusations of discrimination. And that is their goal and that is their job. Whereas the Civil Service Commission was established to take out patronage and all kinds of chaos that had been existing in the state employee system. Every time there was a change of governor, there were a change of massive numbers of employees. And it was designed to facilitate a professional workforce that didn't operate on patronage. And they have the right, under the Constitution, to make the rules regarding employment of state civil service workers. And that's the major difference here.
So, Ken, let's step back a little bit. Why do we have these many commissions we have in this state? I mean, why are they necessary?
Well, Lester, there are literally dozens and dozens of commissions or state government bodies that have the name commission behind it. Some have enormous authority, like the Civil Service Commission that you're talking about. They're basically the state employer. Others just have very little authority. But the theory behind establishing even these commissions that have a lot of authority is sort of twofold. One is to try to reduce the political aspects of making certain decisions. And then secondly, some decisions are just so technically complex that you just don't want, and it's not feasible to have legislators make them. For example, you have a public service commission that establishes rates for utilities. You have a natural resources commission that establishes hunting and fishing regulations, and I don't think you want the legislature doing either one of those two things. But that's kind of the theory behind these commissions that actually do have some authority.
I think the big concern, though, is these commission members are political appointments, even though, as you said, they try to keep politics out of it a little bit. So why are these commissions made up of unelected people making these decisions?
Well, that's one of the sort of historic debates that always occurs about the authority of these commissions. You know, they're not elected. And you see that quite a bit, this debate between the legislature and these commissions. They're not elected. Now, they sort of have what I would call indirect accountability in that many of them, the members are appointed by the governor. They have to survive, advise, and consent from the state Senate, but they're not directly accountable to the people. But once again, the theory is that there are certain decisions that the legislature is probably not in a position to make, but it's always an ongoing debate about whether their authority is too little or too much. And in fact, in the case of the Civil Rights Commission, you had various legislators from both sides of the aisle in there arguing about what the proper authority of the Civil Rights Commission in fact was.
And I also want to point out that some of these commissions are supposed to be appointed in a nonpartisan or bipartisan fashion. And the Civil Service Commission is one of them. They're supposed to be basically two Republicans and two Democrats on that commission. Now, arguably, one could say, how does that happen and how do you know? And that's always a question as well. But there's always an attempt to try to be fair.
I'm wondering why you think Bill Schuette's, Attorney General Bill Schuette's lawyer, waited until after the hearings had been held, they were about to make a decision before stepping in and saying, hey, no, you really don't have the authority to do that.
Well, that's a very interesting question, why the last minute insertion of the comments when there had been several hearings held already around the state where testimony was being taken on this very issue. I don't have the answer to that, and I suspect people will have all kinds of thoughts in their head as to why that happened.
Ken, what are your thoughts?
Well, I guess we'd probably have to ask the Attorney General himself, but my one possibility is that the Attorney General's office kind of watched this going on, and once it appeared to them that the Civil Rights Commission might in fact say they did have the authority, once that sort of became apparent, they might have waited till then to weigh in and say, no, you don't have that authority, because if they acted, then there'd be a legal dispute and in fact a court case as to the authority of that commission, and I think the Attorney General might have been trying to head that off.
That is Ken Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. We also heard from Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic legislator. Hey, thanks. Have a nice and warm late September weekend.
Thank you very much. You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings.
We're here at Long Road Distillers in Grand Rapids, and you can't talk about Grand Rapids without talking about beer, and today we're going to talk about both beer and spirits because Long Road has come up with a Beer City whiskey line.
Kyle Van Streen's here. What does that mean, a Beer City whiskey line? What's involved in that?
So this is our series of whiskeys that we've partnered with local breweries to make. As Tammy mentioned, we're known as Beer City USA. We've been voted that 4 times in a row now. And we're proud to be part of the craft beverage culture here in Grand Rapids and in Michigan as a whole. But we felt like there was an opportunity for us to partner with those breweries that have made us so famous and create a line of spirits that was unique and really highlighted some of their more popular beers. So we've partnered with 4 breweries. The first in the release is from the Mitten Brewing Company, who happens to be our next door neighbors here on Leonard Street on the west side of downtown. We've taken their Country Strong IPA and we've turned that into a malt whiskey, malt being the base grain.
Wait, you're turning beer into whiskey. Tell me how that works.
Well, so a lot of folks don't understand that beer and whiskey are closely related. They share a mostly common ingredient, which is malted barley. And so as long as the base of the beer is more than 51% malt, it can be considered a malted whiskey. In the same way, if you had a wheat beer that was more than 51% wheat, it could be considered a wheat whiskey. The mash of the beer, which is very closely related to our mash, it's just grain that's been cooked in some, depending on which hops or other additives are put into a beer, there's some additional flavorings that happen, but it's an unfinished beer, so it hasn't been fully filtered out, it hasn't been carbonated, things like that. Then we transfer it over into the still, distill it up to the appropriate proof, and then we've aged these beer whiskeys for between 1.5 and 2 years.
So I hear that the way this got started was actually a happy accident with your neighbors.
Yeah, at the Mitten Brewing Company, they've recently transitioned from a 3-barrel system up to a 20-barrel system. And in the process of doing that, they did lots and lots of test batches. Now, every brewer knows that you're going to have batches that go bad with infections and the yeast just isn't happy. And so you have off flavors. And so the Mitten was very stringent about not putting out a product that they weren't completely satisfied, especially with their Country Strong IPA, which is one of their standbys. They've always got it on tap. And so rather than throw it down the drain, we said, hey, let's try it. We'll distill it. We'll see how it tastes, and we can go from there. And out of that, we discovered that it was pretty delightful, especially out of a barrel. And so we had them brew us some fresh batches, put that through the still, put it into barrel, and now we've recently released this first in the series of 4.
All right, we should take a taste of that.
So I love an IPA beer, so I'm really intrigued to see how those hop flavors translate into a whiskey.
Hops and a whiskey. If it's hops, I'm probably okay with it. We'll see. So we've got one here.
Well, it smells like whiskey, but it also has that little bit of a hoppy aroma going on. Wow. So much of that hops on the finish, which I don't expect in a whiskey at all, but I love it.
You like it?
I do. You should try it.
I will in a second. I want to get to the second whiskey, though. You've got another one.
So in addition to our neighbors at the Mitten, we've also partnered with Perrin Brewing Company and Harmony Hall and Harmony Brewing Company and Grayline Brewing Company. All of them happen to be west of the river, which is fun for us, being good West Siders and partnering with the 4 breweries on this side of town. But the next in this release, this lineup of releases, is the Perrin Black, which is a very popular beer from them, one of my favorites that they've produced, and turned into a malt whiskey. This is super mellow. It has a really nice malt roast characteristic. I think it's just a really delightful sipper.
Let's try that. I got to try that. Oh, that's so smooth. That is so smooth. I can't believe that.
What I love, again, I can taste that dark roast malt from a beer that I like in beer and that translates to the whiskey so well. And I also love the fact that it's completely different than the Mitten Country Strong, in the same way those 2 beers would be completely different.
Oh, yeah, it's quite a bit. So do you intend to continue to play around with this and work with your brewer friends?
Definitely. This is just four in a series. This will be our releases for this summer, but then next year we're already planning for additional releases and partnering with more well-known breweries even, so people have that to look forward to.
And that's at Long Road Distillers in Grand Rapids. Thanks very much for telling us about this beer to whiskey. It's great.
Cheers.
Still to come, Senator Gary Peters on the fiery talk between President Donald Trump and North Korea.
When you see some embers, normally the way to get those embers to cool down is not to throw gasoline on them.
And we'll talk about the new Republican health care bill. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's long been the sense that someone should be punished for the Flint water debacle. When decisions lead to water being contaminated by lead and people die because of a spike in Legionnaire's disease thought to be connected to the water, someone should be held responsible. State Attorney General Bill Schuette has responded by filing criminal charges against several members of Governor Rick Snyder's administration. Yesterday, the court proceedings began in an involuntary manslaughter charge against the director of the Department of Health and Human Services, Nick Lyon. In Lansing, there's a lot of water cooler talk about this case. Joining me to help understand why is longtime Republican insider Richard McClellan. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
What's the big concern about prosecuting Nick Lyon?
The concern that I've articulated a number of times is that the Attorney General's approach is very much out of line with the way past Attorney Generals have dealt with problems in state government. And to go after criminal charges to the head of a department that has 14,000 employees and has 29% of the state budget to administer and try to hold him criminally responsible for one decision or, in this case, failure to decide and impose on him a felony murder penalty, basically. The biggest impact on this beyond Nick Lyon's potential future is the impact on all the state employees. If you talk to state employees now, they have suddenly become very, very cautious. They don't know what to do. They don't know whether to act or to not act. They certainly are not going to take any risks. And I think that has a big impact on the rest of us who rely on public servants to make judgment calls and make decisions. If all of a sudden these departments won't do it, it causes serious problems, in my view.
Yeah, in fact, not making a decision was part of the problem with Flint. At what point, though, do you determine if an official has done something that actually warrants prosecution or a lawsuit?
Well, what the Attorney General has done has started at the bottom, like all prosecutors do, and tried to get people to flip and tell him what he needs to hear to move up the chain. His ultimate goal has been to get the governor, who he feels is ultimately responsible, I think. But the governor spent something like $4 million in legal fees and hasn't been charged with anything. So Attorney General's style in these cases, and this is fairly new, like I say, no other Attorney General has done that. And Frank Kelly, the longtime Democratic Attorney General, has written in opposition to this prosecution. So trying to pick one person out of thousands of emails and hundreds of bureaucrats in Flint and in Washington and in Lansing, highly technical matters that are being imputed to Nick Lyon, who is not even a doctor or an epidemiologist. He's an administrator. We're going to find out in this proceeding whether and to what degree the judges and maybe ultimately the jury thinks of that.
The former director of the Department of Health and Human Services and a former state Supreme Court Justice, Mara Corrigan, wrote an op-ed piece for the Detroit Free Press. She outlined how the director's position amounts to great responsibility and doing the best job to protect people. She thinks Lyon will be exonerated, says she's disappointed in Bill Schuette. What did you think of Corrigan's statement?
Well, I have the highest respect for former Justice Corrigan, both as an administrator of department and her time on the bench. She also served with me on the Law Revision Commission. But I think that her comments were very cautious, but deeply felt. I think she thinks this is a miscarriage of justice to even bring the matter. I look at the director as sort of the orchestra leader. He or she is not held responsible for what every instrument player plays, but has overall administrative responsibility. I know what it's like. I was the chairman of the Corrections Commission and ran the prisons. If somebody had told me that I could be held criminally liable because of something some rogue prison guard did up in the Upper Peninsula while I was in charge, I wouldn't have taken the job. And that's what I think is going to be happening. The Attorney General, if he happens to win for governor, is going to have some challenges getting people to work for him and trust him, basically. Now, this particular case is a very complicated case. If you go through the basic charges, it's a long series of string of facts that have to be hooked together to work your way up the chain of cause and facts and get to Nick Lyon, and then accuse him of not doing something on a certain day in a certain way that the Attorney General believes he should have done. Now, if there's one thing we know about the Director of Community Health, basically, which is part of the job, it's a judgment call. Every time there's an illness in the community, you can't run out and put out a press release and frighten people. But you have to be prepared to. That's why we have epidemiologists. And this idea that he, the Attorney General, knows better and his hired gun prosecutor, I don't think Maura Corrigan properly agrees. That's not going to hold up in the long run.
Richard McClellan is an attorney in Lansing and has served in many capacities in state government. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
With us now is U.S. Senator Gary Peters. You are on the Senate Armed Services Committee. I want to ask you about this war of words with North Korea. Yesterday, a North Korean official indicated his country might soon test a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific Ocean. And the nation's leader, Kim Jong-un, has called President Donald Trump deranged. Then early this morning, President Trump tweeted, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is obviously a madman who doesn't mind starving or killing his people, will be tested like never before. That's the end of that tweet. The name-calling might even be kind of funny if we weren't talking about the possibility of nuclear war. What can you tell us about this situation?
Well, Lester, all I can say is it's obviously not helpful to have this kind of exchange of rhetoric back and forth. I'm very disappointed by President Trump that he's engaging in this kind of banter back and forth. I think we've all seen this kind of banter back and forth. We've experienced it when we were in grade school and in middle school, but it certainly doesn't have a place on the world stage, particularly, as you mentioned very wisely, when you're talking about nuclear weapons. This is very serious business. We need to make sure that we're treating it with the seriousness that it deserves, and that means looking at diplomatic ways to try to reduce the tensions instead of throwing gasoline on them.
Former U.S. Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, visited Ann Arbor this week. He's urging patience and not to overreact to everything North Korea says or does. What do you think of that advice?
Well, I think we do have to be measured. We have to be steady. We do have to be strong. And we have to be working on back channels to make sure that we are talking, let the diplomatic work go on and move forward. We have to make sure the Chinese are fully engaged in this as well. I am encouraged that the Chinese seem to be taking some positive steps. They're the ones that have the most leverage over the North Koreans. I do believe we're starting to see a change in their view that North Korea is becoming a problem for them as well. You know, in the past, their fear of a united Korean peninsula let North Korea do what they want and act a little crazy because they always thought it was in their interest. But now that this has escalated to the point where we're talking about nuclear weapons that destabilize the Pacific Rim in particular, I think the Chinese realize if they're going to be players in that region, this is not in their best interest. They're slowly coming to that realization, the fact that they're now going to make sure their banks are not working in financial transactions with North Koreans is a positive first step. So what we need to be doing is continuing to nurture those very positive steps by the Chinese to bring further pressure on the North Korean government to step back from the line, stop this type of rhetoric, and hopefully put a halt to their weapons program and eventually dismantle it. It's simply unacceptable in today's world to have a North Korea with nuclear weapons.
Having said all that, I'm wondering what advice you would give to President Trump if given the opportunity.
Well, he has to speak in a more diplomatic tone. You know, when you see, back to my analogy about gasoline, when you see some embers, normally the way to get those embers to cool down is not to throw gasoline on them. That's just probably the first step. Don't do that. Act presidential. Act as you are the leader of the most powerful military in the world. Folks know that, but that allows you to act in a much more dignified way, in my mind. And then work through diplomatic channels. So work with the Chinese, find out how we can bring them on board, working with the world community, also establishing some back channels to the North Koreans. Certainly that's a possibility to do as well. We've got to be able to have some discussions. Without talk in a civilized adult way, this could end very badly, and we've got to prevent that in every way possible.
Let's turn to some legislation in Washington. Everyone seems to agree the Graham-Cassidy health care bill is the Republicans' last chance to repeal and replace the Affordable Health Care Act. What do you think of the contents of the proposal?
Well, I think if you look at the contents of the proposal, it is worse than the last one that went down, where they were not able to get sufficient votes. So it still does a lot of what the last bill did and then some. It'll end Medicaid as we know it. Hundreds of thousands of people in Michigan will lose their health insurance. People with pre-existing conditions may find that they can't afford insurance to deal with those situations. Older Americans will see an increase in their premiums. Basically, all the negative aspects of the last bill still exist in this bill. And that's why we've had a number of governors come out in opposition to it. And I may say a number of Republican governors that said this would be extremely damaging to the people in their state. So I just have to step back and scratch my head, is that how are folks who voted no on this bill going to change to a yes when it is actually worse than the bill that they've already voted no on? So I know they're getting tremendous political pressure from the Republican base, and I would just hope that they continue to stay strong and do what's right for the American people.
As I understand this Graham-Cassidy health care bill, it would basically give states a block grant to pay for Medicaid in whatever way they wanted to do on a per capita basis. And some states will win, some states will lose. I'm wondering, where does Michigan land in that?
Well, we're in the loser category, and it's the tune of many billions of dollars. So Michigan is a loser in that category. There are a few that win, as you mentioned. One of those is Alaska. And as you know, the senator from Alaska is one that voted no. So it's a pretty clear attempt to influence the senator of Alaska to change her vote in the fact that her state gets a little more money under this bill. But the bottom line still holds that you're going to have tens of millions of people losing health insurance in this country. We don't have a CBO, which is the Congressional Budget Office score. This is the nonpartisan agency that scores bills and really gives us the in-depth analysis of what we are voting on. They have not come up with that. They said it's going to take a little while to do that. And the Republicans want to rush through and vote on this even before we have that data, although we are very confident that data is going to be similar to the past bills, because this bill actually is worse in so many respects.
At this point, we only know of one Republican who has declared he will not vote for this bill. Is it going to pass?
I think it's unknown at this point. You know, there's a lot of pressure being put on those Republican members who voted no. It'll come to the forefront. I think it's important for people to make sure their voice is heard right now. We have to keep going and asking people to do that, and we have to do it once again. You know, I'm heading to a press conference here in a little bit with health providers, folks who are experts in this area, who are strongly opposed to this bill. They're going to talk about the impact on their patients. We're going to hear from patients themselves and the impact on their lives. People need to make sure that their voice is being heard right now. We are at a absolute critical juncture over the next few days.
You're sponsoring legislation to stop tax dollars from being used to put up employees at the White House and the rest of the executive branch at Trump-owned hotels and resorts. What's your reasoning?
Well, it's not just Trump-owned. It's any kind of property that is owned by either the president, the vice president, or cabinet secretaries or their family members. And this is basically deals with really common sense conflict of interest rules, that if you are a government employee traveling on a taxpayer dime, you shouldn't be staying in properties that are owned by your boss. That's, I think, is a pretty straightforward legislation to protect taxpayers as well as to protect from any appearance of conflict of interest. But we do know that there are federal employees that stay at Trump properties. They shouldn't feel obligated that they need to go to a Trump property. We had a recent incident of a Coast Guard employee that spent about $1,000 at Mar-a-Lago. No reason that they were staying there. They certainly could have stayed somewhere else much cheaper as well. We do have in the bill, though, an exception for Secret Service and security folks, which need to be close to the president. But other types of government employees do not need to be staying in a very expensive property owned by their boss.
Yeah, is that practical, though, when Trump is often at his resort in Florida or at Trump Tower in New York?
Well, there's no shortage of hotels in New York or southern Florida.
Point taken. So is there a chance at all that Republicans will vote for this?
Well, there is a chance. I work on the Federal Oversight Committee for Federal Spending, and that's out of that capacity that I've introduced this bill and have a number of co-sponsors, but I'll be working with the chair of that committee, Rand Paul. I think we are going to take a look at travel expenses broadly and what we're seeing at the Trump administration. I'm sure you've seen the recent reports of Secretary Price flying on private jets to the tune of several hundreds of thousands of dollars, even though he could have flown commercial, as all of his predecessors have done in the past. So I think travel expenses is something that needs to be looked at, and I'm certainly hoping we can do that in a bipartisan way. It's part of the congressional oversight role. It's what our framers put in place, that Congress should have a oversight role when it comes to dealing with the executive, whoever is in executive office.
Senator, we only have a couple of minutes, but the Senate recently approved the National Defense Authorization Act. What does that do for Michigan?
Well, it does a number of things. Certainly, first and foremost, it deals with the national security of our entire country. But I've worked on a number of aspects in that bill and language. One recently that I put into the NDAA, which I hope will help us secure the F-35 fighters at Selfridge. It's something I've been working on with my delegation as well as the community. Selfridge Air National Guard Base is one of the finalists to base the F-35, which is the next generation fighter. And we're hoping that we get selected. When the top two are selected, it'll be a big deal for Michigan. It'll mean that base will be in our state for many decades to come. Plus all of the research and development and engineering associated with the frontline fighter, having it located in Michigan is good for jobs in our state. So I put in some legislation to help facilitate that by moving the A-10s that are currently there, that they can be moved to other bases in order to bring in the F-35. And I hope that the Air Force will make that decision, and that will be good for Michigan in terms of jobs in our position with the ability to get further defense contracts in our state.
That is U.S. Senator Gary Peters. I want to thank you for talking with us.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That interview was recorded earlier today. Since then, a second Republican senator, John McCain, has stated he'll vote no on the Republican health care bill. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who checks Allie's work, who checks Rusty's work. Basically, I'm the only one who can screw things up here. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Danny Hensel. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Hey, thanks for listening.